a beautiful country. It's got hills as tall as you can see. It just takes your breath away.
You've got a BNP archipelago made up of 42 islands, Karajini Gorge, Billabongs.
The Waifala will go into a church and feel at ease and relaxed. Well, this is how we feel about the land, yeah?
The red dust on the Pilbara gets in your veins.
Hello and welcome to this land of red dirt and open skies. I'm Kirsty Melville from the ABC, and today, along with Neil Trevithick from the BBC, I'm taking you on a journey south from the pristine Kimberley region of Western Australia we visited last week to here, the Pilbara.
There's no doubt that the Pilbara is a fantastically beautiful place, on par with the Kimberley. But the difference is now for 40 years there has been mining. But it is only in the last 10 years has there just been a burgeoning of mines opening up all over the Pilbara. Once you could drive and not see another person for a whole day. Now you're lucky to go 10 minutes without another vehicle coming past you.
In many parts of the world, that would feel like a very long time.
Welcome to the Pilbara. Beautiful, remote, and the powerhouse of the Australian economy.
Introducing the mine of the future.
The new force in iron ore.
1966 for Tom Price, then Paraburdoo, 1990 the Channa joint venture, 92 Brockman.
You've got the Pluto project through there.
94 Merrindoo.
The Pilbara may sit alongside the Kimberley on the map, but it's a different world. A world of fluorescent yellow and blue, high visibility mining shirts and steel cap boots. A world where mile after mile of power lines rudely interrupt the watercolour landscape that stretches as far as you can see. A world that's been inhabited by Aboriginal people for tens of thousands of years. And a world where Indigenous land rights have clashed with industry for decades. This is where the people of the Kimberley are looking to see what their world could become.
We oppose mining in the country. We reject it completely. But we don't have a choice.
Rio, Dampier Salt.
2004, Eastern Range.
This is ore over here, salt over this way.
They make billions of dollars. We're still in poverty.
2006, the Maldi.
We would like to stop mining there.
It's a powerful place and looking after it is our priority.
The Rio's up around the 300 million tonne a year, as is BHP.
$12 billion expansion for the harbour.
2012, the Warrumbu deposit.
Colin Barnett, Premier of Western Australia. Well, Western Australia is arguably the world's largest and leading mining economy. There is production that's about $110 billion a year. Western Australia produces over 60% of Australia's mineral production and around 75% of Australia's oil and gas production.
How much of that comes from the Pilbara?
Oh, the Pilbara is the dominant area. I would guess off the top of my head about two-thirds of that probably is accounted for by the Pilbara, which is primarily iron ore, and Western Australia produces over 20% of world iron ore production. The other major contributor is natural gas, which is converted into a liquid, liquefied natural gas for export. Currently, Western Australia produces around 20 million tonnes a year of natural gas, or LNG. We expect that the production from this state will treble before the end of this decade, and then it will be a toss-up between Qatar or Western Australia as to who is the major LNG producer in the planet.
Here in Port Eden now we're doing around about 160, 180 million tonnes, and they want to go to 350, 400 and even half a billion tonnes of just iron ore.
FMG's around the 40 and they're striving to get up to the 300 million tonne a year.
360 million tonnes per annum.
A million tonnes a day. Yes. This is one company, one region.
And then if you look at Dampier, you're going to be shipping about a billion tonnes of minerals out of the Pilbara every year. And that's a lot of dirt to be shipping out, a lot of minerals, a lot of money, a lot of wealth.
This state only has 2.4 million people. We occupy an area larger than Europe. So let's get it in perspective. 73% of all of Australia's exports to China come from Western Australia. This is not a backward, dig-it-up, ship-it-out economy. It's the most sophisticated mining, the most sophisticated and heavy haulage rail and communication systems, science and technology.
Bravo 1, Alpha 7.
Alpha 7, Bravo 1.
They say in Western Australia, you're either pro-mining or very pro-mining. But few people actually make it out to where we are now. One of the giant pits at Rio Tinto's Mesa A mine, near the company's town of Panawanica.
Right, Arthur, tell us where we're off to.
Okay, we'll head out to Warrumboo first, to the Warrumboo pit, which is the newest part of the operation. The stockpile that you see over to your right is low-grade material. We use that low-grade to dirty up the grades, basically. Otherwise, we're supplying a customer with a product that's too good.
I've heard that before.
We've got to keep our customers satisfied. Yeah, so the truck that's just been loaded heading away from us is one of the newer 830E Komatsus. They're a 230-ton payload truck. The digger is a 360-ton Hitachi excavator.
Does the digger just sit here all day doing this, tipping around, digging, pulling it around, dumping, turning around, digging, picking it up, dumping?
Yep.
All day?
That's what they do.
All day and all night?
Yep. It's a simple process, so drill, blast, load and haul. That's it.
I have had some miners admit to me that it is like playing in the world's biggest sandpit with the world's biggest trucks, and it is as much fun when you're a lot older than when you're a boy doing the same thing, and they love it.
So the iron ore that we can see being dug up here today, where's that going?
Japan.
So you dig out the ore, you send it to Japan in ships, they make giant dumper trucks, and you then buy them back.
Well, yeah, pretty much, yeah.
But predominantly a lot of the steel that's being made is going to China for us and going towards making those cities. So it's building the cities of the future pretty much.
They're also building the mines of the future. Many of the trucks and iron ore trains working these mines are being remotely controlled from high-rise headquarters in Perth, 1,500 kilometres south of here. It's a real-life video game. And whilst the Pilbara might be raking in the cash for Australia, many to the north in the Kimberley, who we talked to last week, see the Pilbara as ruined, a mining wasteland. Traditional Aboriginal lands and cultural heritage lost to mining, and towns overrun by highly paid fly-in, fly-out workers. And that's true of parts of the Pilbara, but much of it is still empty country. Still the untouched wilderness it was when Arnold Carter came to town in the 1960s.
Here you go, Kirsten.
Hello. Oh,
good indeed. Come in.
Lovely to see you. Nice and cool and air-conditioned in here.
Indeed. OK, I've been arrived in Port Hedland on the 23rd of February 1962. It had a population of 1,100 people. 50% of those were Indigenous.
What kind of industry was here then?
Purely only pastoral industry, only sheep. And I was approached one day in Perth from a delegate from Consinc Rio Tinto, and they said to me, we're doing a feasibility study on iron ore. So I hopped on an aeroplane and lobbed at this place called Borgita, and it was absolutely in the middle of nowhere. It was at the bottom of Mount Tom Price, and I've been here ever since.
What were the predictions back then about how much iron ore there was to be found here?
The predictions were always good, but they didn't mean anything because at that stage the Commonwealth government had an embargo. You could not sell iron ore because the only buyers in those days was Japan. China wasn't even on the equation. And so Japan was the only one that was buying. Of course, the Commonwealth government said no, the iron embargo wasn't lifted until 66. Once the embargo was lifted, I'll never forget it because it comes through on a Saturday morning. You know, I went down the pub and we made the announcement, and within a week there was 1,200 people arrived here in Port Hedland. They thought that it was ready to roll. We hadn't even mined 1 ounce of iron ore. They were living under the jetty, they were living everywhere. You know, it took us about 18 months before we signed up with Utah Mining. They constructed the port, they constructed the railway line. We didn't even have roads. You know, everything used to come in by state ship. They used to bring all the food in, and the beer used to come in. Port Hedland had nothing.
But today, Port Hedland is heaving with industry. Trains nearly 3 kilometres long carry iron ore past the town from the inland mines, past a white mountain of salt, another local industry, through to the processing plant at the port, before it's finally loaded onto ships at the world's largest bulk export port. The traffic on the four-lane highway linking the port to the town of South Hedland rivals that of a major city. Except it's almost all four-wheel drive mining vehicles with the obligatory high-visibility flags waving in the wind. And real estate prices? Well, now there's a story.
OK, I'll take you for a drive around Port Hedland and just show you some of our wonderful houses and you can get an idea of our great prices. This one here just went for $1.2 million. These ones here have just been rented for around about $800 a week. That one there is rented for $900 at the moment because it hasn't had a roof. it will probably go up as it gets renovated.
I am gobsmacked by how much this town has changed in the last 5 years since I was here.
It's changed dramatically, not all for the good either, particularly as far as I can see for where Aboriginal people are concerned and the local community is concerned as well.
Bob Neville runs an Aboriginal homeless support service, the Bloodwood Tree.
I feel sorry for all the other towns and I'm going to feel sorry for Onslow now because Onslow is going to get absolutely decimated.
What's about to happen at Onslow?
The gas, all the gas hubs there.
From Gorgon?
From Gorgon, yes. Mm. Yeah. Onslow's got it there. Onslow was a nice little quiet coastal town. It was a great beaches and that sort of thing. You stay overnight at the motel. You can't get in there now. It's just full of fly-in, fly-out workers and housing at $2,000 a week, same as it's here in South Hedland.
There's plenty of new housing for fly-in, fly-out workers.
Oh, yes. There's plenty. Plenty. And if you see where Gina Reinhardt's camp is there, you can...
Which one's that? Port Haven?
That's the BHP one, that one. Here, Gina Reinhardt's building her new 1,200-person camp right here.
Is that Hamilton Motel, that one?
No, that's FMG's
another one.
One.
Oh, OK.
But Gina Reinhardt's one is right here, and that's right in the shadows of 2 Mile where the homeless people are. You know, even if you're on $150,000, $160,000 a year, you cannot afford to buy a house up here in this part of the world. It's just too expensive.
We are a town of extremes. We're a town of haves and have-nots, and we live side by side. A lot of people are making a lot of money. The making of the money does come at an expense.
We have a lot of young people, and yes, they are on good money, but they're also a lot of them are living at home and they're living with a lot of family members, 15, 16 people in the house, and there is no other option for them because of the high rents in this town, because there just is physically no accommodation left in this town.
And, of course, then they started that monstrosity of a thing called fly-in, fly-out, which to me is the destruction of the Pilbara, because all of a sudden the family component just disappeared. Kids' enrolment ceased, and trying to get people to assist you in the sporting organisations, there was nobody available. So that created a social disaster.
Fly in, fly out, or FIFO, is a way of working peculiar to mining here in Australia. The workers literally fly into this remote part of the country in their thousands. They work for 3 or 4 weeks solid, living in small rooms called dongas, a luxurious cross between a shipping container and a small flat. And then they fly home for a week. Many live on the east coast of Australia, as far from here as Moscow is from London. And they shuttle to and fro, fly in, fly out.
Where are you from?
Newcastle. 4 weeks and then 1 week home.
You got kids?
Yeah, three. What does happen is after a couple of years of that, you go home, your wife's playing up with a neighbour, the kids are all delinquents because you're not there for 4 months.
So why are you doing
it?
I'm just here to see what the place is like, and it's like life on Mars, right? That's where I thought I'd landed when I came here. They love it in red, isn't it?
I'm on a 3-in-1 in Hedland for 19 days and fly home to a couple of kids and a wife.
How much time do you spend in the community here?
None. We work 12-hour shifts. We come here, have a couple of quick beers and then go and have tea, have a shower and go to bed. That's it.
All I do is eat and sleep here, fly out, then I take my money home.
The places that offer the kind of money that you're looking at are not the kind of places that I want to take my family. It's remote and not a great place to bring up kids.
What's happened to the families, the locals that have lived here for years? Where are they?
There's none, because they're all fly-in, fly-out. And if you've got no children, there's no wives. When the fly-in, fly-out started, all of a sudden you were getting a single person, very rarely a woman, it was mainly men, and they were receiving good money. All their meals were paid for, so the money they actually got in their hand was money that they could use elsewhere, and that's what was happening. They were getting all this good money and going down to places like Mandurah and Rockingham and buying nice comfortable houses, and the family and the wives would live down there, and the man would come up and do his hourly shift and go on. So I said to the mining company one day, I said to him, what about building 15 houses for me? And he says, Arnold, he said, 15 houses, that would cost me $15 million. He said, but if I spent $15 million, Arnold, I'd be spending $15 million on a bucket reclaimer. A bucket reclaimer, if you don't know what, is one that picks up the iron ore off the stockpile, puts it onto the conveyor system, and the conveyor system puts it into the ship. That was the attitude, that they'd rather be putting it into something that's going to earn them income.
We've come down to check out Port Haven, which is a purpose-built accommodation facility for the fly-in, fly-out workers. It's a strange place. It's made up of hundreds and hundreds of what we call dongers. When you enter the complex, it's like walking into a gated community, completely self-sufficient with its own pool, its own tavern, its own dining room.
There's lots of mining overalls hanging up on the clotheslines. It's absolutely silent except for the cleaners going from room to room with their trolleys of cleaning materials, as if it's quite a upmarket hotel, really.
There are tennis courts.
Swimming pool.
Everything they could want is here.
Well, I'd live here.
Wives and the girlfriends come up to check up on their husbands and their boyfriends, right? On the 7 o'clock plane, and at 11 o'clock they're looking for the plane out of here.
Why are you here?
I like the money.
You get the phone calls late at night asking her to talk her through some crisis in the household, but you don't get anything out of life unless you're prepared to give something up.
Recently I've done 4 months straight.
Why would you do that?
Money. Pure money.
You got a plan?
I'll make a lot of money, then I'll go and spend it.
What do you do when you're at home?
Eat, drink, sleep. Drink, 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 sleep. Eat, drink, 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 sleep. And go back to work.
I guess you either have a good relationship or a quick divorce.
How much do you all talk about that sort of thing?
Surprisingly, a lot.
They're away from their family. I think they're unhappy. I know how I feel.
The question is, who does this mining boom belong to? That's the question. Who does this mining boom belong to?
And that's a great question. A question Bob Neville asks himself every day as he drives around South Hedland.
This is the area affectionately known, and unfortunately is 2 Mile. You can see all the litter to the left there. There's been an area burnt out there. You can see all the cans and the litter is here.
There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cans.
There certainly are, yep. You can see some camps over there. There's one there with the makeshift shelter in the shadows of Gina Reinhardt's 1,200-man fly-in, fly-out camp. You can see hundreds of millions of dollars going into this construction over here for fly-in, fly-out workers, and how much can we see going into the local Aboriginal people here? I think the sum is actually zero.
Diane is one of these people. She lived out at 2 Mile, the shanty town on the fringes of South Hedland, for a year with three of her kids. Before that, her kids lived out there on their own for a year while she was in prison. The oldest was just 16 at the time.
Even my little boy was with the drunkards beyond 2 Mile.
How old was he?
1 year old.
So he was 18 months old and living out in the bush?
Yeah.
With homeless people?
Yeah.
Were the other kids going to school?
No, they were looking after one another. They had no money to care for themselves.
How does it come about that a mum goes to prison and a 1.5-year-old child is left living in the bush? How does that happen?
I certainly can't work it out. Basically, they slip through the cracks.
Did anyone talk to you about what arrangements would be made to look after them while you're inside?
No.
Can you describe what 2 Mile is?
It looked like a refugee's. Like violence and people drink too much, fight too much.
A camp is usually an old mattress on the ground. There's no water out there. There's no services whatsoever. These people are destitute. It's a very sad situation for Port Hedland, the richest town in Australia, yet we have thousands of people homeless.
Thousands.
Thousands.
Aboriginal people up until comparatively recent times, in the sense of history, were nomadic. And the development since European settlement has been quick and has disturbed their traditional cultural way of life. So I acknowledge that. The problem is dislocation of people, alcohol, lack of skills, lack of education, health levels are low amongst particularly Aboriginal children. So that is Australia and Western Australia's greatest social challenge. And I don't think you can simply say, well, you've got a wealthy mining industry, why are people living in poverty? There are far more complex and deep-seated social differences.
My little boy, he was really sick. He had diarrhea, he had flu. Nobody wanted to take him to hospital.
Yes, yeah. I've helped to support them to get the children to hospital on a regular basis for dysentery and, other health concerns.
Do doctors or nurses, community nurses, go out to those camps?
No, not around here. They're going to walk themselves to the hospital.
Do any services go out to the camps?
No. People supposed to come help. We had cyclone coming. We had no shelter. We were just sleeping like rubbish, you know. Remember carrying the baby just for you.
It's one of the most confronting things I've seen in Australia. There's the disparity right next to each other.
Yes, and I'm not in denial about that. So it's not necessarily about availability of housing or income. It's the way in which those communities are able to manage themselves. I think what is interesting, though, that we are seeing more Aboriginal people employed within the mining industry, which was long overdue. And as a state government, on major projects the state is involved in, we are going to extraordinary lengths to make sure Aboriginal people are included in the development. What I find most encouraging is the emergence of a group of young Aboriginal leaders who are determined to take their people away from welfare dependency to an economic self-determination. That is something I strongly support.
Half hour here on the BBC World Service, we get back on that wide open road and drive even further south to meet some of those young Aboriginal leaders Premier Colin Barnett speaks of. Those working on caring for their country, those fighting to save their country, and those determined to avoid the widening gap between the mining haves and have-nots here in the Pilbara. I'm Kirsty Melville, stay with us.
Millions of us across the world have insurance, whether it's life insurance, health insurance, or cover for homes or crops or livestock. But is it money well spent? Have you paid your premiums only to find the insurer won't pay out when you make a claim? Or has insurance been a lifeline against an uncertain future? Your Money investigates. Also in the programme, as some micro-lenders are accused of exorbitant interest rates and aggressive debt recovery tactics, we'll ask whether micro-loans are a good way to borrow money. And loyalty cards, whether from supermarkets, airlines or mobile phone companies, are they good value for customers? And we want to hear your experiences and stories too. Email us, wsym@bbc.co.uk, to get in touch. Join me, Paul Lewis and Leslie Kerwin, for Your Money, online from Tuesday at bbcworldservice.com.
Coming up in the next half hour, opponents of the Kimberley's James Price Point development, who we heard from last week, want the gas pipe to the Burrup Peninsula in the heavily mined Pilbara region of Australia. They talk of the Pilbara as if it's already been ruined by mining, but it's far from it. As we'll see, it's home to the most ancient Aboriginal rock art on Earth. Join us shortly for more Red Dirt Dreaming as we keep driving south through the vast land of Australia's northwest.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. The newly elected president of Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta, has promised to work with his defeated rival Raila Odinga and serve all Kenyans, in his words, without fear or favour. Mr Kenyatta was declared the winner of Monday's election by the narrowest of margins, but Mr Odinga said he would challenge the result in court. A radical Islamist militant group in northern Nigeria says it has killed 7 foreigners kidnapped last month. The group, Ansaru, said it took the action because Nigerian and British forces had killed Muslims in an operation to free the hostages. The British Foreign Office is trying to verify the reports of the killings. There have been protests in Egypt after a court verdict over a football match riot a year ago. The court sentenced 2 former security chiefs to 15 years in prison, but acquitted other officers, prompting protests in the city of Port Said. In Cairo, rioters targeted buildings and Egypt's Football Federation near the stadium of the club, whose fans made up the majority of 70 people killed last year. Protesters have set fire to dozens of homes in a Christian-dominated neighbourhood in the Pakistani city of Lahore after a Christian man was alleged to have made blasphemous comments about the Prophet Muhammad. The former South African president Nelson Mandela has been hospitalised for what officials say is a scheduled medical check-up. A spokesman for President Jacob Zuma said doctors were treating Mr Mandela for a pre-existing condition. Venezuela's election authorities are meeting to choose a date for the presidential poll, with April the 14th said to be the most likely date. And 3 days before Roman Catholic cardinals in the Vatican begin the process of electing a new pope, a special chimney's been installed on the Sistine Chapel for the smoke that will announce the result. Black smoke means no decision, white smoke that a new pope has been chosen. BBC News.
As we leave Port Hedland and drive south through the Pilbara, it doesn't take long to leave industry behind. And then we're back driving through this vast, open, hot land of endless skies and rich beauty. This is the land Australia's Indigenous people have been walking for tens of thousands of years. It's an uneasy paradox, that collision of beauty, industry and cultural heritage. And there's no real estate in the Pilbara that's been as hotly contested as the Burrup Peninsula, near the towns of Karratha and Dampier. It's where 30,000-year-old Aboriginal rock carvings sit alongside massive industrial development. This is where many opponents of the gas hub at James Price Point in the Kimberley want the gas piped.
So here we are, driving through the middle of Dampier, and over here on your left you can see carvings everywhere. Over here on the end of my street. So can you see those carvings there?
I can.
Quite a few animals there, and you can't move too far on the Burrup or the Dampier Archipelago without stumbling across heritage plates. I mean, every 5 metres.
Brad Rowe is the development coordinator for the new Murujuga Ranger program out here on the Burrup Peninsula. For the first time since white settlement, Aboriginal traditional owners here are being paid to care for their country.
Carvings are basically a roadmap. Our fellas, when they go on country, they know their way around through the rock art.
Because the drawings all represent something, speaks to them, tells them a story.
That's right. You've got to remember that most of these people have been pushed off this country. You know, in an area a couple of hundred k's along coastline is covered in industry. There's obviously benefits for Australia economically, though when it's the oldest and the largest congregation of rock carvings on the planet, I think there has to be some compromise. All yours, Del.
Ironically, it's now industry rather than government that's putting in the big money to preserve what's left by funding cultural heritage programs like the Murujuga Rangers. In 2007, the rock art on the Burrup Peninsula was given National Heritage Listing. And the two big industry players here, Woodside and Rio Tinto, had to sign conservation agreements worth millions to preserve the rock art.
My name is Ken Mulvaney. I'm the Cultural Heritage Principal with Rio Tinto, based here in the Dampier Archipelago. We're actually on top of an old campsite. There are shells which date from the last 4,000 years that we know the Aboriginal people collecting from the nearby beaches. But we also have industrial areas, in particular the recently developed Woodside Pluto gas plant and Yarra fertiliser plant, and then adjacent to Yarra fertiliser is the new technical ammonia nitrate plant that will be going into construction next year, and they've just started to clear the land. So literally within a stone's throw of where there is art, we have industry. If you could imagine Stonehenge having a petrochemical plant sitting next to it, that is what it looks like where we are now.
The local Aboriginal Murujuga Rangers, funded by oil and gas giant Woodside, are also out on the Burrup.
Yeah, my name is Dallas Fredericks and I'm the cultural safety rep for the Rangers. We're out here on the Burrup Peninsula, also known as Murujuga. And we do manage rock art, so we like the eyes and the ears out here on the Burrup for the old field. Because it was a lifetime dream of an uncle of mine, old David Daniels, that he wanted Rangers to be out here to work on country, to look after the country that the old people wanted to look after.
My name is James Woolley. I'm a local Roving boy, born and bred there. I'm the team leader of the Rangers. I was working in the mining industry before this. Always wanted to do a job like this, looking after something that I'm passionate about. Yeah, I taught these things at a young age through law and culture, and it's always been a part of me. Now we've got an opportunity for us to tell our side of the story instead of white people being involved, like archaeologists and people who've been coming up and down through this place for years and documenting it and taking it away and archiving it for themselves, not to show the Aboriginal people. Our main view is sort of like to archive it for ourselves and put it in our own database.
What the Rangers are starting to archive, with the help of their circle of elders, are more than 1 million ancient rock carvings. Everywhere you look, there's a carving on the side of a rock.
But where we're standing now, we're at the entrance to the main valley with the creek, which is starting to dry up now because we only get rains with the cyclones. Up the slopes on either side of us, there are images on almost every rock surface. Some are very clear, ones that were done within the last few thousand years, to some which are much older, up to 30 plus thousand years. These valleys, where there's water, where there's shade, there's food resources, that is where you get literally tens of thousands of images.
And that's all the way along the peninsula?
All the way along. The most obvious you'll see are there's turtles and bird tracks just further along in the valley. But there's some nice kangaroos and there's a beautiful little Pilbara pebble mouse that's halfway up the slope that you can see.
So what does the rock art mean for you? What do you see in it that a white person doesn't see?
It's the connection to the country. Every carving connects you to how your people was in those days. It tells you about what they hunted, what their spiritual dreaming was, what their culture at that time was, places they visited, practiced their ceremonies.
This whole area is a very sacred, like a Bible on its own, sitting out here, and where we can try to preserve what we still have here.
There is nowhere else in the world that has literally the sheer number of images, but more importantly, the art is depicting 30,000 years of a continual tradition that is reflecting both the cultural practices at the time as well as the environment at the time.
Where we're standing right now, you in particular are facing right towards the gas plant.
A bit of culture shock, isn't it? You got literally art here thousands of years old next door to the Woodside gas project, which has been here for about 20 years roughly, early 80s.
How much was lost?
Literally thousands. But in the early years, like I said, they didn't consult with Aboriginal people. They blew this place up. My grandfather and a few of the old people came out here to survey this place. Anthropologists tried to save some rock art out here, which they did. There's a compound up there where most of the rocks have been moved to. Thousands, literally thousands of carvings. They are very aware of all the damage that's been done to this.
It wasn't until the landmark Mabo Native Title case in 1992 that Aboriginal ownership and right to land was acknowledged here in Australia. This legally obliged resource companies to negotiate compensation with the traditional owners of the land they were operating on. It was a big win for Indigenous people, But it also led to bitter competing claims between different tribal groups, particularly in areas where big money was up for grabs. In 2002, just as the native title fight was getting nasty on the Burrup, the government and the claimants controversially agreed to extinguish native title and try something new. The Murujuga National Park has just been created, and it'll be co-managed by all the groups once fighting for native title. But where all the rangers live, just 40 minutes drive away in Roebourne, it's a very different story.
To be honest, I'm glad there's no Native Title Act here. I see that as a good thing here at the Burrup.
Is all the language groups working together?
Working together, yep. Not one group has got rights here, there's five groups here. Native Title has destroyed these families here in Roebourne. Causes a lot of infighting amongst a few groups in town. Absolutely ripped us apart.
If James Price Point is what everyone's talking about in the Kimberley, down here in the Pilbara, it's the ongoing and increasingly nasty fight between iron ore miner Fortescue Metals Group, FMG, and the Yindjibarndi Aboriginal Corporation, or YAC. This multi-million dollar battle is being played out in the most unlikely of settings, the small, dusty, predominantly Aboriginal town of Roebourne. We've arrived the day of a big meeting at YAC, and the young fellas are outside in the 40-degree heat cooking the most delicious kangaroo tail stew over hot coals.
We're just making a fire to cook those kangaroo tails. Back in the days, before the settlers came in, that's the way we traditionally cooked the kangaroo, was under in the ground. You get them, you put them on the flames, and you let the fur burn off first. You just scrape the fur off with a stick or a knife, then you just move the coals out of the way.
This one here must have come from a pretty big kangaroo.
It looks like it came from an old boomer, actually. Main animal, what you got now? Blue road?
Yeah.
For this one, you're looking at probably about 6 foot.
He'd look you in the eye.
He'd look you in the eye, yeah. He'd probably punch you too. Probably stand up on his tail and give you a kick. Look how strong his tail is. Freedom, well, it's
just like gold. The jovial mood here today belies the tension that's been brewing in Roebourne over the past few years. Here's the story. The iron ore miner FMG approached this community in 2008, wanting to mine the nearby Solomon Hub, a project worth billions of dollars on an area of land over which the Yindjibarndi have a native title claim. Roebourne is a poor town struggling with overwhelming social issues. It may not want mining, but it could really use the money and the jobs. By 2010, though, negotiations had broken down. FMG put an offer on the table, the people rejected it. Michael Woodley is the CEO of YAC, the Yindjibarndi Aboriginal Corporation.
The first offer that they made in 2009 was $1.5 million a year.
For how many years?
The life of the mine.
Life of the mine.
All of the operation in our country, no matter how much I know that they're extracting from it. And we obviously said, well, that's just not on, because how do you expect us to support our education desires, our situation with poor health and housing and so on and so forth? So we said, this is what we think you should be paying us, right?
And how much did you say?
We said 5% of royalties.
So based on the last year's worth of business, if that deal had gone through at 5%, how much would that have been worth to you?
Well, back when we put the offer on the table, an iron ore price was something like $180 a tonne. So $68 million a year.
$68 million a year.
Well, this is on a project that has been also reported to generate for FMG at $280 billion.
Why did you think that was reasonable?
Well, first and foremost, this is our country. And I don't think I should need to explain anything further than that. I mean, if you're operating outside of Africa, for instance, or Iran or Iraq or whatever, you'd be paying more than 5%. And you'll do it respectfully. But because of Australia, you know, they think they can walk all over the indigenous people. Right? There's an industry standard already that Rio Tinto have gone to the Pilbara people and said, we'll pay 0.5%. They made that offer to us as well, and we accepted it. So what we said to FMG at the end of the day, Rio's paying this, I think BHP is paying this as well, it's kind of standard industry rates. We'll settle for 0.5% and still a no. They've also said that, look, we don't want to replace government welfare with mining welfare. We prefer to give indigenous people jobs and training and business opportunities.
Well, is that happening?
Well, they say that it's happening. But Rio said, look, we'll give you 0.5%, right? And we'll give you every other thing as well. We'll employ you if you're up to it. We'll train you if you want to.
And is that happening?
And that is happening.
There's not one place we've been to on this trip to the northwest of Australia where either mining or native title has left a community united, and Roebourne's no exception. As negotiations with the mining company dragged on, some people just got fed up. Yindjibarndi elder Alary Sandy was one of them. She's now with a breakaway group, the Wurlamurra Yindjibarndi Aboriginal Corporation. This is the first time Wurlamurra has told its side of the story of why they split. It's important because, as you'll hear later, much has been made of FMG's alleged role in helping set up the group.
There was always argument arising within the meetings that the elders questioned where is Yindjibarndi at now and what is happening. And we were always told there's nothing. And we're told, be quiet, you don't know what you're talking about. And then family feud started and abusing started. And I've had enough. And I said, I've had enough of seeing you bullying our old people. You know, you got no respect. And that's the time when we broke away. And when we broke away, there was a reason and a purpose for that, because we've had enough of being bullied. We had enough of not being heard, and we had enough of not being respected as an elders.
We all used to go to the meeting. We used to sit down and listen, but we don't say anything, you know. Only one man speak, always one man speak. If, you know, old people want to get up and say something, he said, no, sit down, don't talk anything. We used to sit down there and just keep our mouths shut, you know.
One day in a meeting I said, I wanted to talk, but somebody else interrupted and said, oh, kuyo, you chachanganyonga. You said, you're talking no good, you're talking rubbish there. And that's really hurt my feeling, you know. And after that, and I said, no, hang on a minute. I still raised my hand. I said, hang on a minute. I'm an engineer. I should be heard here. And they shushed me up, and they said, oh, yeah, you'll fall in a ditch, they said to me. Well, I raised my hand. I said, I'll forgive you for all the things you've done and said to me, but I will move on with Wurlamurra.
So it's been a bitter fight right from the start.
Out of that came FMG's dirty tactics, what they've been doing along the Pilbara before reaching anybody, talking to a few individuals who had different ideas and agendas. It's better for them to deal with individuals and manipulate them than to deal with a community that has a strong vision.
There's been a series of issues calling FMG's integrity into question. Several consultants have come forward claiming they were told to alter reports or not get paid. And there's long been suspicion Wurlamurra was set up by the mining company.
You know, every time we pick up a newspaper to see, where's our story? Always a story about white men splitting us up, but it never ever happened that way. It never. Wurlamurra was split up by their own people, their own Yindjibarndi people.
Peter Mers is a director at FMG.
Fortescue definitely did not set up a rival group to Yak. The Yindjibarndi people, they are the landowners. Yak is one organisation that represents the people. And we were approached as Fortescue by other people from the community, particularly the women, that really wanted to work with Fortescue.
I don't know what's wrong with the people. We just want to get on with it. When we, with the mining people, we're benefiting. Our town's been a troubled town for such a long time. Our people are suffering within our community, and we see that. I'm going to try with all my heart to try and help my people, no matter what comes our way.
Do you want mining on Yindjibarndi country?
We can't stop it. You can't stop it.
This whole messy saga is being played out very publicly in the Australian media. All sorts of allegations are being hurled from one end of Roebourne's main street to the other. And whatever the truth, what gets lost in all the media flurry about this bitter falling out is that much of Yindjibarndi country has been lost to mining.
Behind is another a drill line, or they're going to be looking for samples. And once that happens, you'll be certain that this area is going to go. Caves, which are very significant to the Yindjibarndi people, where we use them for shelter, or when the old people might use for burial as well. And they're going to end up, at the end of the day, killing this place. And we're going to have nothing left. And they do it for one thing. They do it, you know, for commercial gain.
Lorraine, can you tell us a bit about Yindjibarndi country?
It's beautiful. The Yindjibarndi country is the most beautiful place on earth.
You know, everywhere you go, you think it's desert, but it's just, we know where the water holes and the rock holes, and everyone thinks it's dry now. There's always water somewhere.
Well, it's a big country, made up of rugged hills, and in between those are gullies and gorges and rivers, mainly filled with spinifex and river gum trees and bloodwood trees and snappy gum trees, so stuff. To me, it's paradise, really.
What's culturally important in that land?
Everybody's identity. That's who we are. Everything about us is based upon our religious beliefs and observances on that country, from speaking language to practicing ceremonies, singing songs. All that stuff is part of the Ijebori, you know, religious observance.
How much of your land is under mining tenement?
The whole lot is. The whole lot is. It's all he's got. Got to get
around. Yeah, John, I need some help for the kangaroo tails.
So, Hayden, were you born in Roven?
Yeah, I was born in Wickham. I lived in Roven for all my life. And my father's Michael, so we lived out in a community when I was a young boy. But apart from that, yeah, mostly in Roven. Close-knit culture, and nowadays, because of natal title, you get class and you get stressed off into groups, and now you're Ijebori, now you're Ngoluma, now you're Bunjima. But yeah, still that kid over there is Ngoluma, is still my brother, and I've known him ever since I was a little boy. Hurts your heart, doesn't it? You know, you've got families torn against each other. It's devastating for us as young people.
So can you go out to Solomon Hub now, Warrathimji?
No.
Why?
Because we tried to go out there to document some sites that they found, but they barricade the road for us. Yeah, well, tell Bameshna, I'm busy, baby. All we want to do is show our kid what was there. We would like to stop mining there because it's a beautiful country. It's got hills as tall as you can see, you know, and valleys you can... It just takes your breath away. You know, who want to give that up? And if mining is going to be there and it's going to take all that away from us, they're going to destroy this hill, they're going to destroy that river. That river connected this river, and that river is like a big jigsaw puzzle in our country. So no mining, nothing to destroy that for us.
You'd give up all of that potential money to have your country?
Yes. Because we're rich. We're already rich with our culture. Bringing thoughts and dreams
to my mind. Mining is God in Australia. It's king and everything that makes the world go round. Nothing stops mining. Government viewed as, you know, economy growing, and so nothing can stop it. This is deliberate, because it legitimized the taking of our lands again.
It's a confusing few days we spend in Roven, making sense of all the allegations and counter-allegations. But really, it's just sad. Everywhere we go, we hear those words, before mining, before native title. But this is not a news story. The river through Roven is dry due to a dam being put in upstream after another lost battle. Elders here remember playing in its water. Now there are only memories painted in the astonishingly beautiful paintings for sale in the art gallery. Roven is a kind of no man's land, caught between boomtime capitalism and a culture for whom land is their everything. But there are positives here too. Rio Tinto alone employs 1,000 Aboriginal people in the Pilbara, FMG 300. Between them, more than $300 million worth of contracts were given to Indigenous businesses last year. And some negotiations are genuinely respectful and sophisticated, and the money on offer a springboard for economic empowerment. But most of the Aboriginal people we met are engaging with the mining industry because they have no choice. They're simply trying to get the best deal they can. For the Ijebori people of Roven, perhaps their best chance at reconciliation lies an hour down the road back at the Burrup Peninsula, where they're having to work together to co-manage the brand new Murujuga National Park. The last thing they need is the gas that people in the Kimberley want piped down here so as to preserve their pristine wilderness at James Price Point.
When you talk about it simply piping the gas to the Pilbara, they need to come and have a look at the heritage place here. We do not need any more heavy industry here. because there's enough damage being done here already.
We'll be fighting again. That's just putting more heat on us. We're just trying to preserve what we got left.
Our governments need to start looking at the way they're handling this stuff.
Ship that gas plant right to Colin Barnett's front door.
House. Yeah, right at his front door. Yeah.
For Aboriginal people, it is their one roll of the dice. This is the critical decision they're making, and I can understand the emotional pull that places on people. They are just so fearful of not getting it right. And yet, I think they understand this is their one opportunity for economic self-determination. So the pressure on individuals, the leaders of the Aboriginal people, is very great.
I feel completely and utterly, utterly broken that mining continues happening on our country. You can see the country doesn't sit right no more. The balance is gone. The animals become more and more hard to see. The rivers doesn't run anymore. The trees are dying. And it doesn't feel right. You can feel it once your feet hit the ground. Everything about it is off. They've taken the power away from the Ngara, the Aboriginal people. He's no longer in charge of his country and the day-to-day decision-making of it. It's like walking on an unbalanced landscape.
In this vast landscape, even huge industrial development is a mere pinprick, the equivalent of just one seat in a massive football stadium. That's the Whitefellas argument. But for Aboriginal people, that pinprick, that one seat in the stadium, is some mob's entire country, some mob's nation. Think about this. If someone from the corridors of power offered your community, your family, millions and millions of dollars in exchange for the loss of your land, your culture, your place of worship, your connection to country, your complete way of life, would you take it? Human nature being what it is, half of us probably would, and the other half would almost certainly go down fighting.
Now, if we're going to go down, because we're up against a multi-billion dollar company that has government in their pockets, then we must go down fighting. Take me back to my country once again.